Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the iPro Strategies to Reduce Avoidable Acute Care Hospitalizations conference call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require operator assistance during the conference, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this conference call is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your host for today's presentation, Ms. Vicky Agramonte. Ms. Agramonte, you may begin, ma'am.
Thank you, Howard, and good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us this morning. Just as always, a few housekeeping issues to remind you of. As Howard stated, this call is being recorded and will be posted to the iPro Home Health website within 7 to 10 days. So you can certainly, share with your staff some of this information, and we know that your frontline staff may find this information very valuable. Also, as we're entering in our final quarter of our educational series, many of you have already responded to the information that we mailed you out at the end of last week to register for our final 3 teleconferences of the 8th scope of work. So we are saddened to see this initiative come to an end, but again, as always, we're going to strongly encourage you to move forth with your quality initiatives, and certainly, we will be here to support you, but as many of you know, there will be some significant changes coming ahead in the future. Just to give you a few updates, and as things are unfortunately coming to a close, again, I'm going to keep repeating that our initiatives are just getting started. So for all the work that you've done in home health as an industry, you need to move forward full force and continue to move our statistics to where we can all be proud of what the fine quality of work that we know our New York providers provide to our patients. Just a few reminders, our Home Health Quality Improvement Campaign reports, many of you whom did not register for the campaign have found a different type of report in your mailings last month. So we thought, our kiosk, our head QIO in Pennsylvania, rolled this out for the rest of the nation to take advantage of. They will not last for long, but at least you can get some idea of where you stand with your acute care hospitalization statistics, as well as some of the raw data they've pulled from your OASIS, such as the days of the week that your patients are being hospitalized, as well as some of the discharge information pulled from your raw OASIS data. Just to also remind you, as Sarah had sent an email to remind you all last week, your home health compare data has been updated to reflect October of 2006 and September of 2007 data. Pretty much we're status quo. Nothing has really moved significantly other than us seeing a change by 1 percentage point to discharge to the community. We did see a decline by 1 percentage point for patients, for our incontinence patients. But we also know that many of you are working on that measure on your new plans of action, and we'd be anxious to know how you're doing with that. So pretty much we haven't seen much change with our acute care hospitalization rate, although our emergent care rate did go back down to 24% as we saw in the first quarter of 2007. Also, just to remind you that now Home Health Compare has also in the lower left-hand corner where you would see the last time the page was updated, it's now giving you an indication that your data has been updated. It's a very simple addition to a website that we're positive will help resolve much confusion regarding the data updates to that website. Also, I'm sure you are all well aware of the launch of the homehealth.newyork website, supported by the New York Department of Health, which is looking at the home health and hospice profiles, which includes information regarding our certified agencies, our long-term home health care agencies, our licensed agencies, and New York State hospice organizations. And it's pretty much similar to the information that is seen on Nursing Home Compare, giving information regarding your survey activity and how you did on those surveys. So we know it's, and also, of course, your outcomes are posted in a format different from what you're used to seeing. So also from what we understand, that information is being pulled from Home Health Compare. So there should be similarities between the data posted on both websites. That's, of course, your Home Health Compare website and the Home Health and Hospice Profile website with the New York State Department of Health. So without further ado, we are very pleased to have with us again today, as all of you may know, Dr. Darren Triller is our clinical pharmacist here at iPro. And prior to coming at, here to iPro, he was a faculty member of the Albany College of Pharmacy and has spent 8 years working with home health agencies here in the Albany area, studying medication use systems and medication safety among community-dwelling elderly. He has a number of clinical studies and peer-reviewed manuscripts to his credit, and he continues to support our efforts in home care quality across New York. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Dr. Darren Triller.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Vicki. Thank you again. I always enjoy speaking to the home health agency. So hopefully we can cover some material today that'll be helpful to you and to your staff. We are starting a little bit late, so if I run long, I may just keep going, and you can either feel free to skip out at 10 or, and come back in to check the recording later or to stay over if time allows. So let's just go ahead and we'll get started. So we're going to talk about drug safety in the new millennium. I think in 2008, we're no longer at that point where the 2000s are new. I think we're really fully into the millennium. As far as drug safety and medication use, I really think that our perspectives on drug use are going to change. I think they have to change. And our expectations for what we can afford, for what we can expect to see from drugs, and I think we're going to have much more of a hair trigger to stop medications or to avoid using medications unless they meet certain criteria in the future. So let's move ahead to the second slide. So today I hope to review clinically some of the functional processes necessary, especially in your home care patients, for safe ambulation, discuss the effects of medications on these various systems in the body, and propose some ideas that you may be new to you or things that we may have discussed previously that will help change your systems at the home care agencies and as you relate to other providers to improve the safety of your seniors. So going on to the next slide, if the heading is, can you say overrated? And I'm sure being all in New York, everyone can recognize that these are the New England Patriots and Tom Brady. And we all had these, you know, if you listen to the press, you knew that they were the second coming. They were the best team ever. They had the 72 Dolphins sweating because they were the best football team ever, and they were a lock to win the Super Bowl. And as New Yorkers, we can proudly and affirmatively say that, to an extent, that team was overrated, that they didn't really deliver on all the hype and all the expectations. Great team, yes, but we were sold to a certain degree, and we all bought into this idea that they were going to run the table, and they didn't. So how does this relate to medications? So we're going on to the next slide. I think a lot of that, those expectations, those unrealistic expectations, also apply to medication use. I think we went through a period in the 80s and the 90s where the expectation was that there is a drug for everything, every drug will be wonderful, and if there is an ailment, there is a drug or several drugs for it. And really, going into 2009 and forward, I think we've got to change that attitude, and I think this comic gets to that point, saying this is one of those new miracle drugs. It's a miracle if you can afford it. And we're realizing now with Part D, with New York State Medicaid expenditures, with the budgets we're looking at, that we can't afford to treat every single ailment with every single drug for every single beneficiary or New Yorker and stay solvent, nor are we convinced that treating every single disease with every single available drug actually provides the benefits that we expect them to. So we really have to be much more skeptical as we move ahead. So moving on. So what are some of the most overrated modern drugs? And I'm sure a few probably come to mind. Going on to the next slide. Here's a Scientific American posting from March 2008, and the fallout from the Vioxx scandal continues. So here's a drug that came out with much fanfare and yet is no longer available due to a number of reasons. Let's go on to the next slide. So what do we know about Vioxx? And we knew when it first came out, or we found out after it came out, that it does increase heart attack risk, which is the reason they took it off the market. So that was news after the fact. But I challenge you to think back and say, what did we know about the drug before it came out on the market? The fact of the matter is that drug, Vioxx, was never purported by the company to be a better pain reliever than what we already had on the market. If it was a better pain reliever, they would have advertised and marketed it as such. The truth be known, it was never proven or suggested that it was better than Naprosyn, better than Motrin, better than any of the other available NSAIDs. So it was a drug that millions and millions of people received that was never supposed to be and was never expected to be a better pain reliever. The reason it got all the play was that it was supposed to reduce the ulcers associated with the use of NSAIDs, but the studies they compared, when they compared it largely to placebo. So it caused fewer ulcers than placebo or to other NSAIDs, but they never necessarily compared the ulcer rates to patients who were receiving the GI protective drugs that were actually the standard of practice. So we bought into it, we started using it, and yet didn't really pay enough attention to the fact that we weren't getting better pain relief, that we weren't certain that it reduced ulcers, in our, especially in our high-risk patients, more than what we were already doing, and yet 25 million or so patients got the drug. Beyond that, even if they caused fewer ulcers, Vioxx and the COX-2s didn't eliminate ulcers altogether, so that even if you continue to use them, and we saw increased use of them because of this purported safety, they still kill and harm tens of thousands of people a year, causing acute renal failure, hypertension, and other problems. So we have a drug that came out with a lot of fanfare, all these high expectations, but if we realistically looked at that drug and realistically looked at our patients and said, what do we want to get from this drug? We want pain relief without them perforating, having acute renal failure, and having those problems. We weren't entirely certain we were going to get that from that drug if we were really had the appropriate skepticism. Our elderly patients who you're caring for in the home care environment are the highest risk of all those side effects, and they're probably the least likely patients to be represented in the studies that purported that the drug was helpful. An interesting side note on the ulcer safety of the COX-2s, they found that in patients who also took an aspirin a day, which most of your patients do, the ulcer rates were the same as the other NSAIDs. So that safety benefit was only for those folks who were not taking aspirin. But if your patients are on Coumadin, they're on aspirin, they're on Plavix, that benefit's not necessarily there. So the take-home point, at least on Vioxx, is that, and the other drugs, the COX-2s, were that all the NSAIDs should be used at minimum dose necessary for the shortest time period. It was a lesson we already knew going in, but we somehow forgot as we moved ahead with all the fanfare for the new drugs. And actually, if you look at the pain level of pain control and things, in many of our seniors, maybe the narcotics are actually safer. Aside from constipation and some other issues, they may actually be safer in our patients than the NSAIDs. So I went into a lot of detail on this one drug, showing how the fanfare and the hype and the expectations were too high. But there's a number of other drugs that have met similar fates recently. So let's go ahead a slide. Here's a quick snap from an article about the new sleeping pills, so things like Ambien. And here's a middle-aged businessman who found himself driving down the road, you know, and going to McDonald's or going to the bank or something and coming back home and not even realizing it. What did we expect from the drug? He wanted a medication that would help him sleep and wouldn't make him groggy in the morning. What did he get? He got, down two tanks of gas, ingested 1,500 calories, and woke up the next day and went to work wondering what happened. So what are we doing? What do we expect? And then what are we really getting from the drugs? If you look at that slide a little more closely, the ad to the right is for a BlackBerry. I just thought it was kind of interesting that maybe the reason our middle-aged businessmen and people can't sleep at night is because we're checking email messages and phone messages at all hours of the day, and we're living a lifestyle that we could address a lot of these problems if we changed how we were, living our lives. So let's go ahead a slide and say, okay, are you running on Dunkin'? Think about how we're living. How many of you stopped at Dunkin' Donuts on the way in this morning? How many of you stopped on the way to Dunkin' Donuts every morning? And if we're living on caffeine and donuts and things, is it any surprise that we've got type 2 diabetes, hypertension, insomnia, many of these things? So we're as much to blame, perhaps, as our patients. But the point is, a lot of the drugs we're using to treat the sequelae of the lifestyles we lead. And many of your patients, your elderly COPDers and a lot of these other folks, you are caring for conditions that are worsened or originate from the lifestyle choices we've made over time. So going forward, newsflash, the maker of Avandia is warning people if they stop taking the drug, their price of stock will fall, and that's true. So we're seeing a lot. There's big marketing involved. There's $1 billion on the table for the average prescription drug. brand name drug between research and development and advertising. There's a lot of money on the table, so marketing is so, so important. But let's look at Avandia a little closer and go on to the next slide. There's a picture of Dr. Steven Nissen from the Cleveland Clinic, who you'll see him on the news now very often. He's a very outspoken critic of the FDA and very thorough evaluator of new drugs and their harm in the market. And so this slide relates to analysis he did of Avandia. So one of the most commonly used drugs for type 2 diabetics will lower hemoglobin A1C and will help lower blood sugars, which is something we really like, except for the fact they found that it increases the risk of cardiovascular disease, which is the number one killer of patients with diabetes. Step back and ask yourself again, why do we want to give someone a drug for diabetes? We want to prevent kidney damage. We want to prevent blindness and neuropathy. We also want to keep them from dying from heart attacks and strokes. And on a given day, when you go to a home care patient visit, if they've got diabetes, if you were to walk in your home into the home and find them harmed or dead, they're going to die from the heart attack or stroke. It's not going to be because their blood sugars were too high and most of your type 2 diabetics. So here's a drug used for diabetes, prescribed to millions of people, that they think may as much as double the risk of heart attacks and strokes in the highest risk patients. We need to be more critical of the drugs we use and why we're using them, especially in your heart failure patients. We need to be avoiding these drugs in heart failure patients. But I know many of the home care patients with heart failure, they're on these drugs, and they've been shown to increase fluid retention and adverse events and exacerbations in your heart failure patients. Moving on, real quickly, other drugs. NatureCore was a drug that came out, was compared in ICU settings in acute fluid overload in heart failure patients, was shown to be as effective as nitroglycerin, which we've been using for 30 years, cost 1,000 times more, 100 times more than nitroglycerin, was supposed to be more titratable. That's why we were using it. And when they looked at it more closely, they found an increased length of stay in the ICU, increased renal failure, and might actually increase mortality. There's a drug, we dropped nitroglycerin that we're familiar with and jumped on a bandwagon to use a drug that it was strongly marketed, but when we really look closely, it's causing problems. I hope you're not all thoroughly depressed yet. Let's move forward. Here's a little bit closer to home, Women's Health Initiative. We now have a generation of women who were told for 30 years that you're supposed to take estrogen when you start getting to change in life, to control those hot flashes, strengthen your bones, reduce your heart attack risk, perhaps prevent Alzheimer's disease, you name it. All of the claims and the purported benefits of estrogen supplementation are now going by the wayside, and it's gone full circle. We know that they increase heart disease risk or are not protective. The data on cancer and thromboembolic disorders is troubling. And so now it's come full circle to a point where they only recommend hormone replacement therapy in patients who can't tolerate the symptoms of menopause, and then they should only use it at the lowest dose possible for the shortest time period. We had women taking these for decades and now realizing what the problems are associated with the drugs. Go on to the next slide. So I won't be accused of having dated material. This is from this morning. It's not in your slide set. There is, if you go to yahoo.com this morning, there is a there's a story on a new study on estrogen linked to benign breast lumps in patients who take estrogen only. So I apologize that you can't see the slide, but the previous evidence said that estrogen and progestin together was problematic. But in women who had hysterectomies and things, that they could take estrogen alone, they're now finding even in those folks, breast lumps and precancerous lesions are more common in the folks who take estrogen. So now you should be on the slide, that ugly graphic entitled Comparison of Anticholinergics versus Placebo. This is a graphic of a summary of overactive bladder drugs, which many of your patients are on, and direct-to-consumer advertising is saying you have to be on these drugs if you're incontinent. You have to be on these drugs if you've got bladder spasms. And what this summary does is compares all the available studies and looks at leakage episodes per 24 hours versus placebo. And that line down the middle, the vertical line, if the little horizontal line intersects that line, it means the drug is no different from placebo. And you'll see study after study after study either was no better than placebo or slightly better. And when they pool all the best evidence on these overactive bladder drugs together, they reduce incontinent episodes by an average of 0.5 episodes per day. Now, a half a trip to the bathroom, I don't know if they go halfway and turn around and come back, or if it's a Tuesday, Thursday, they save a trip thing. But the fact of the matter is, if your patients are incontinent 6, 8, 10 times a day and are in Depends, it's highly unlikely that these drugs are going to make them continent. And the problem is, all these drugs are anticholinergics, which means they block acetylcholine in the various systems of your body. Acetylcholine is the neurotransmitter that is diminished in folks with Alzheimer's disease. These drugs can induce signs and symptoms of cognitive impairment. They can cause constipation, dry mouth, all these other side effects we want to avoid in the elderly. We're giving these drugs to millions of seniors, and we're not necessarily assessing whether we're getting what we want for it. So I would argue if your patients are taking these drugs, they probably have a dry mouth, they're probably constipated, they may have cognitive impairment, and if they're still wearing Depends, you could make a very strong argument to get them off the drug. So let's go ahead. Another slide. Fascinating thing. Price plays part in perceived power of medication. Say that 10 times fast. This is out a week or two ago, or more than a couple weeks now, where someone did a study looking at the placebo effect, and they found that if the placebo was told to the patient cost more, the patients responded to it better. That placebos, if you tell them they cost $250 instead of being a generic placebo, the patients responded better. So it begs the question, how much of the response we're seeing to drugs and things is based on the marketing and what our perceived benefits are? And I think it's been shown that physicians, if they talk up the benefits of a new drug, the patients are more likely to respond to it. So we really have to think, what are we getting for these drugs if a lot of this might actually be in how we perceive things? Next slide, drug approved. Is the disease real? Here we have fibromyalgia has been kicked around as a disease entity for a number of years, but now the early researchers who defined the term, coined the term, are now questioning whether it is in fact really a disease. Yet Pfizer's marketing a drug for the disease, and there's debate as to whether it actually even exists. And the FDA's approved a drug for the treatment of a disease that may not exist. So, why do I care? Going on to the next slide, why should all of you care? You care because you're caring for 80-year-old people who are on 15 to 20 to 25 different medications. And as this slide illustrates, they are at the highest risk of having adverse drug events that are going to cause ER use, hospitalization, or death. And study after study after study shows this. The number of patients taking prescription drugs goes up with age, the number of drugs they're taking escalates, and you know your population is probably the highest risk outpatient community-dwelling elderly group. So they are the highest risk patients, so we really do need to care as home care practitioners. Going on to the next slide. So how do we realign this thinking? If I haven't scared you to death entirely, what do we need to do? We really need to realign our thinking and agree that drugs are to be only used when they're absolutely necessary. It can't be, let's try this, and especially in our elderly. Too many drug interactions, too many adverse effects. They're too costly. It should be really clear we're using drugs for a specific reason. So I'd encourage your case managers to really pay attention to why are my patients taking certain drugs? Are they working? Am I getting the benefit? Are they harming my patient, and can we get them off of things if we're not certain that we're getting that benefit? Drugs that are used should be based on the evidence of impact on real outcomes. And by real outcomes, I mean the clinical outcomes that we care about. In your diabetes patients, a blood sugar is a nice thing to control, but the real outcome of interest is avoiding heart attacks, avoiding strokes, avoiding premature death. Preventing kidney damage, preventing blindness, preventing neuropathies. If the drugs aren't proven to do those things, we need to really be very skeptical about them. There are drugs that were studied for arrhythmias decades ago. They reduced PVCs, but when they looked at mortality, the rates went up. So we're using these surrogate outcomes of blood pressure. We don't treat blood pressure to treat the number. We want to reduce heart attacks and strokes. Blood sugar is a surrogate outcome. We don't treat sugar to treat sugar. We want to avoid those things. So we really need to be much more skeptical and only want to be on the drugs where there's real evidence or a very high likelihood that they're going to be helpful. Drugs are to be used for specific indications. I know there's a lot of off-label use out there and things, but we really need to make sure we're sticking close to home. Now, that one bullet point, the drugs are to be used for specific indications. I break prescription drugs and all drug use into three different groups, and I think it would be helpful as your staff assess their patient drug list to try and break the drugs into these groups. There's 10,000 drugs out there. They're not going to know what everyone's for or how it works, but it would be helpful, I think, to consider each of these drugs in these different classes. Drugs are either used for symptom control, treatment of an actual disease, or prevention. And I don't want to belabor the point or go into a lot of detail, but symptom control, those drugs for pain, GERD, things like that, we really need to make a point of assessing, are they working or not? If they're not working, your choices are to either get the dose increased or switch to something else. But in no cases should a patient be on a drug for symptomatic control and not have it work. For treatment of a real disease, you want to make sure, is it working? If it's not working, do you go up on the dose or do you try and get something else? Your Parkinson's patients, you know if they don't take their drug, what's going to happen. But if it's not working, we really need to consider what else we can do for the patient. The last one is the sticky wicket. The last one is the prevention of a likely event. And that's where a lot of the new drugs are being developed and marketed. Drug treatments for blood pressure, for cholesterol, for diabetes, a lot of these are drugs that are designed to prevent something from happening. But how certain are we of that event happening? And from a marketing standpoint, would you rather develop a drug that you take for 5 to 7 days to treat an acute infection or to treat something short term, or would you like a drug that you can get 30% of the population to start taking and have them take it every day for the rest of their life? From a marketing standpoint, the best money is in developing a drug that people are going to take to prevent disease. But what you've got to decide with those drugs is, how likely am I to experience that? If I've already had a first heart attack and I'm diabetic, I want to be on a statin. My risk of having that heart attack is very high. If I'm a 45-year-old woman and I exercise, eat right, and don't smoke, do I need to start thinking about taking a drug like Fosamax or one of these other drugs when my risk of having a fracture in the next several years is so small? So these preventative drugs, we really need to think about them. And our elderly patients, we need to think about their prognosis. How likely is it that they're going to experience these events or live to realize the benefit of the drug? Is starting a statin on a patient who's 93, who is diabetic with COPD and has a longevity of maybe a year, going to see the benefit if the drug doesn't kick in for 2 or 3 years? So those are things we really need to think about. Drugs are to be removed when they're ineffective or when the risk outweighs the benefits. We don't do a good job in the seniors of taking stuff away. A specialist prescribed it, so no one will ever touch it and they'll be on it the rest of their life, is no longer sufficient. And it gets to my last bullet point, that drug regimens should be periodically reconsidered. That's not reassessed. It's not reevaluated. I really think that periodically, every 6 months to a year, they ought to sit down, multidisciplinary team, and I gave the similar presentation to some long-term care folks just last week, that the perspective should be reconsideration, because we really, the threshold, the skepticism's got to be much higher now for keeping people on drugs, especially when they're on so many. On to the next slide. Risk versus benefit, what are you trying to accomplish? And this is an individual who thought that the risks of starting a fire near his house with perhaps children around on a swing set outweighed the were worth it to get rid of the beehive on the swing set, if you look closely. And we're doing that with a lot of the drugs. You know, we're starting things that are high risk, and we're not really thinking about what we're trying to get and what the real benefits are. So I can't belabor the point enough, but we really need to think about what are we likely to expect from the drug and what are the risks and costs, side effects, interactions, and patient harm. So going on. Role of home care practitioners is to really pay close attention to the medications. Med reconciliation is huge. Making sure the drugs that the patients are on, that they're adhering properly. We need to be more responsive to side effects, to issues with adherence, to really have more of a hair trigger, to be critical of the meds and to act. And we need to do a better job on those drugs that are getting lab monitoring and things to ascertain those lab results and to act on them. Coumadin comes to mind. We have so many patients out there on warfarin, and study after study shows that that's the most likely drug to put an elderly person in the ER or the hospital or to kill them. So we really need to be much more proactive as we assess the patient meds. Always suspect medications as a cause of any new signs or symptoms in the elderly. Until proven otherwise, anything new that's going on a patient, elderly, on a number of meds, should be considered to be drug-related and report anything suspicious. So what about reducing falls and reducing these adverse events? I'd like to swing a little bit into how the drugs are affecting your patient's ability to ambulate and what your staff can do to better comprehend how the drugs are working and how to change their approach to the patient. And we're running a little bit late on time, so I'll run through a little bit of this kind of quickly. But when you think about what you need to stand, and we all do this very, you know, get up, you run, get a coffee, you stand up, you ambulate, we don't think twice about it, but there are many, many systems at work that are very, very fine-tuned, they are orchestrated, they must work together perfectly to allow an elderly patient especially to stand and to move safely. And those range from your voluntary nervous system to your actual muscle strength, visual acuity, and your cardiovascular system. You need to be able to vasoconstrict to maintain your blood pressure when you stand. You need enough fluid volume to maintain your pressure to your organs. You need to be able to carry enough oxygen. You need enough sugar. Your heart rate needs to be able to pick up, and your stroke volume needs to pick up. All these things need to happen so that when you stand up, your pressure is maintained to your head, and you don't get dizzy, syncopal, and fall. So move forward. What's needed to avoid injury? Now, falls are not so bad if they didn't hurt people. You know, if you remember the Weevils, you know, the Weevils wobble, but they don't fall down. Or the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer with the Bumble, when he fell off the cliff at the end. But he wasn't hurt because Bumbles bounce. Well, wouldn't it be great? It'd be kind of weird, like at our seniors, if they fell but never got hurt. That if they're just falling around and say, I'm okay, like my 9-year-old, and pop up, I'm okay. That would be fine. It'd be weird, but it'd be fine if they fell and didn't get hurt. But the problem is that when they fall, they're frail and they're getting hurt. And the things that contribute to their harm, their bone density is less, so their bones are more frail. And a lot of the folks, especially if they're on anticoagulants, are at increased risk of hemorrhage, intracranial hemorrhage, and things like that. So we really need to not only worry about the falls, but we need to worry about, are our patients being harmed? And now let's think about how drugs affect all these different systems. So let's skip the next slide where it's medication's part of the problem, because we already talked about that how many patients are on more drugs. And let's go ahead to the picture of the elephant. The elephant, this slide's just to illustrate the point that there are drugs that if you give enough of one single drug, they will, you could take down an elephant. This is an elephant that has a dart sticking out of its posterior, and apparently they're sedating it at a zoo or something. My 9-year-old keenly observed that guy's going to get killed when he goes. But there are drugs that if you give enough of one drug will cause a patient to fall. And that ringing in the background is the phone that my daughter messed with, and it's making the ringer go off that I don't know how to make it stop. Okay, so the elephant, one drug can bring down your elephant, but when you go to the next slide, you'll see that teetering, that balance. What we're talking about with our seniors is not typically one drug that's going to make a patient go down. And I've had nurses ask that this patient in a fall, which drug caused them to fall? It's a balance of all of those systems. It's a balance of enough muscle strength, plus enough visual acuity, plus enough cardiac output, plus enough dexterity. It's that fine balance. And depending on what drugs they're on, what conditions they have, a little bit of any one of those or any combination of those is going to bring it all down. So the next slide. Of all those systems, what do the drugs affect? And you'll be surprised when you start going through the drugs as to how a patient on 10 or 12 drugs can have perhaps every single one of these things affected by the drugs. So let's go ahead. So voluntary nervous system, many drugs can impair the ability to control voluntary movements. Perhaps some of you have experience with the first. So alcohol is a great example of a drug with a dose response curve. If you take a couple sips of wine, you're fine. You take a full glass, you get to a certain point. But as you escalate the dose, you can get to a point just like that elephant, and you've seen it, where the person is completely incapacitated. Other drugs can do the same thing. Benzodiazepines, these sleep aids like your Ambien, antipsychotics, narcotics, things like Dilantin, Phenytoin, Neurontin, all these drugs, as you go up on the dosage curve or as you give them to patients who are more sensitive, can have their voluntary emotions blunted, hindered, impaired. So voluntary activities, just the initiation of the motion and the ability to follow it through, is affected by many of the drugs our patients take. And if you think about your patients, how many might be consuming alcohol, a benzodiazepine, an antidepressant, perhaps a low-dose narcotic, and maybe something for neuropathic pain. Your patient on 15 to 20 drugs is on three of those, or four of them, or five of them, and that's just the first system we touched on. Go on to the next one, muscle strength. We don't think about it, but drugs actually can affect muscle strength as well. Chronic corticosteroids are probably the ones that are most likely to contribute to actual muscle weakness. They cause that proximal muscle wasting. So your typical COPD patient has those skinny little chicken legs and the skinny little arms. If they're on chronic prednisone, it's because those drugs cause proximal muscle wasting and they don't have the strength. Many of the other agents, if they're getting exposed to different chemotherapy agents, perhaps vitamin deficiencies, can also contribute to myopathies, muscle weakness, and things like that. But your chronic corticosteroids are folks you really need to watch for muscle weakness. Going on, visual acuity. We don't think about it, but your elderly patient, especially change of time of day, getting up in the middle of the night, things like that. Part of it is they can't adjust to the changes in light, plus their actual visual acuity is less. And many of the drugs we give to our patients affect this. The anticholinergic drugs I talked about earlier. So the OAB drugs, they cause your eye to be less able to accommodate to changes in light. And other drugs are anticholinergic, such as Tylenol PM, and your tricyclic antidepressants like amitriptyline that a lot of our folks are on. So many, many of the drugs affect their visual acuity and their ability to accommodate to changes in light. So we need to tell our patients when you get up, make sure you take your time. Let your eyes adjust. At certain times of day, you need to be more careful because they can't see as well and they're more likely to trip and fall. And other drugs that I've listed there can contribute to cataracts, to corneal deposits, and other things. The erectile dysfunction drugs can change color perceptions. And so it's in the package inserts that pilots can't take it within a certain number of hours of flying because they might not be able to see the lights on the runway. All right. Moving on, vasoconstriction. This is a really important physiologic response to changes in posture that is entirely necessary. When you stand up, especially if you stand up quickly, the muscles around the veins in your legs and your lower extremities have to constrict to increase that blood pressure or else the blood will pool and you'll get orthostatic when you stand up. Many, many, many of our patients are taking multiple drugs that blunt this ability. They blunt the effect of vasoconstriction. Your heart failure patients, your hypertension patients, they're taking beta blockers, metoprolol, Coreg, even the eye drops, the beta blocker eye drops like Timoptic for glaucoma can be absorbed through the mucosa around the eye and can cause lowering of blood pressure and vasodilation. Drugs that also are used for BPH in your elderly men, such as Flomax, are alpha blockers which block the constriction of your blood vessels. Calcium channel blockers such as Norvasc, they're used for angina or for hypertension. Vasodilators such as your nitrates and hydralazine, especially your PRN nitrates for angina, the sublingual tablets, they all cause this vasodilation that put patients at risk of orthostasis and falls. And many of the older, what I refer to as sloppy drugs, such as those tricyclics, your old phenothiazines, drugs like thioridazine, like Melorel, some of the old drugs, also act as vasodilators. And again, think about your patients on 10 or 15 drugs. How many are taking a beta blocker, an alpha blocker, and a calcium channel blocker, and some PRN nitroglycerin? Probably most of them. Going on, plasma volume. Even if your blood vessels constrict, if there's not enough volume in this circulation, they can't maintain the pressure. So dehydration is a very important thing in your elderly patients as they stand and ambulate. One of the problems with this is you know when a patient's on a vasodilator, you know when they're on the beta blocker and things. Hydration can probably change quicker than many of those other systems, that a patient can become dehydrated just in a number of hours. An elderly person with a bout of diarrhea or some vomiting, a PRN dose of Lasix, some dietary indiscretion, you name it, these things can change very quickly. So your patient's taking loop diuretics, thiazide diuretics, your caffeine drinkers, a lot of these folks can be dehydrated. If they're immobile and they're not eating well, you know they're not drinking enough, and that puts patients at huge risk of being orthostatic and falling. So system after system, if you don't see a recurrent theme here, this is your typical home care patient on many of these drugs. Oxygen carrying capacity, your COPDers can't oxygenate well enough. but many of your patients may have anemia due to chemotherapy, HIV, perhaps antibiotics they've taken, and some of the drugs can actually cause overt pulmonary toxicity, such as amiodarone, that often goes overlooked. So we really need to make a point of checking those CBCs routinely and making sure that our patients are not anemic so that they can have the full ability to carry oxygen. Smoking's another one I don't have on the list there, but the carbon monoxide in the smoke actually binds to your hemoglobin so it can't carry as much oxygen. So I know we try and encourage patients to stop smoking, and they say, yeah, yeah, yeah. I would tell the heart failure patients and those COPDers, you will feel better if you stop smoking. I don't care if you smoke. Smoke all you want, but you're going to feel better if you stop smoking because you can't carry oxygen, and sometimes that gets through to them. Moving on to blood glucose, hypoglycemics. Many of our patients are on insulin. That's right up on the top of the list next to warfarin for drugs that put elderly people in the ERs. And so especially some of the newer drugs can cause hypoglycemia, especially around the time of dosing. Our nurses really need to pay attention to whether the patients are eating or not. Giving a dose of some of these potent hypoglycemics and then having a patient not eat a meal puts them at great risk for hypoglycemia, and they can fall. I had a patient who was a great example of why glucocorticoids or your prednisone can be a problem with falls. And what you see a lot of is your COPD patients going in the hospital. They're put on antibiotics, they're put on a prednisone taper, and they're sent to you. And what they do while they're in the hospital is they also do all those labs, and they say, you're diabetic. And this one patient I'm thinking of is like a 55 or 60-year-old woman who had COPD and came out of the hospital newly diagnosed as diabetic. And so they started her on insulin and sent her home. And when I arrived at the house, she's lying on the couch, you know, in a daze, wondering what's going on. And what had happened is the steroids, prednisone and the other corticosteroids, are also referred to as glucocorticoids. They drive your sugars up. And what happens over and over and over again is your patients go in the hospital. They're in a stress situation, so their sugars go up. They're given high doses of glucocorticoids, so their sugars go up. So they put them on insulin, and they put them on higher doses of the medications, and then they send them to you. And then what you do is over the next week to 10 days is you take away those drugs that are pushing their sugars up. But if we don't adjust their sugar, their diabetic drugs downward, they are then going to get hypoglycemic and crash. So I think at one point, if you took anything away from the day, it would make sense to possibly have a policy and procedure on assessing your patients who are on prednisone tapers, especially if they're on diabetic drugs, because their sugars need to be watched much, much more closely as they take away those steroids. And you see it over and over and over again. It'd be a simple thing. We could put together an educational program on it if you'd like. But say, if you're on a prednisone taper and that patient's diabetic, we better watch them a lot closer. Going on, cardiac reserve, heart rate, and contractility. You need to have that heart rate be able to pick up. You need the contractions to strengthen, to increase your cardiac output when you stand and you ambulate. Many of these same drugs that you've already touched on affect your heart rate. Digoxin, you know, beta blockers. The appropriately dosed beta blocker patient's going to have their heart rate kept around 70 beats per minute. You want your heart rate to be able to pick up when you're ambulating and things, but many of our patients are on drugs that don't allow it. Beta blockers, calcium channel blockers, amiodarone, and DIG are common drugs that control heart rate. And so if you think about the cardiovascular patient collectively, they're going to be on a drug that controls their heart rate, perhaps controls their contractility. They're going to be on a diuretic. They're going to be on a vasodilator. And if you think of all those systems, you basically put them in a box where all of the reflex mechanisms are controlled so they can't accommodate when they stand up quickly and things. So we have to allow our patients to dangle their legs, give them time to come. We have to train the patients and train your staff to say, you don't have to know what every single one of these is doing to this patient, but if you think of that tipping point, you have to realize they're on five or six drugs. And if you go to the next slide, what don't the drugs affect? They're on drugs that affect every one of these systems. So hydration has to be watched very closely. It changes so quickly. We need to say every one of our seniors is going to be taught to dangle their legs for 60 seconds before they get up. Every one of our seniors is going to stay put for 30 to 60 seconds holding on to something. Because if we don't do it for everyone, we're not really doing it. We talk about quality improvement initiatives and systems, but if we're not doing it all the time, we're not really doing it. And so if the patient's in a hurry, they're not going to do it, and that's when the fall happens. If the staff is in a hurry, they're not going to do it, and that's when the fall happens. If we're going to take a systems approach, we're going to assume, like universal precautions, that these polypharmacy folks are going to have these systems stunted. So therefore, our universal precautions are all of our staff are going to be trained to have our patients dangle their legs and take their time going up, getting up. We're going to do orthostatic blood pressures on all our patients to make sure that we're watching them very closely. All of our patients are going to have their hydration checked in a periodic, systematic way, because if we don't do it, we're going to overlook these things. All right. Going on, how might the drugs affect the degree of injury? We talked about a lot of the drugs that put the patients at increased risk of falls. What are the drugs that are going to affect their bone density and their coagulation cascade? I know we know a lot of the drugs that patients take, if it's illicit drugs, can affect the environment that they're in. And a lot of our patients don't have the family and the support systems to respond appropriately. But let's focus on the bone density and the coagulation cascade for a moment, just to bring it all home. So going on to the next slide, drugs can increase the risk of fracture when they fall, and we're back to those chronic corticosteroids. They cause bone wasting. So your patients who are on them long-term are going to be at increased risk of osteoporosis and osteopenia and really need to be paid close attention to. There are fewer patients out there, but there are some folks that are getting frequent or continuous heparin due to different disorders, and that also will cause bone wasting. But the chronic corticosteroids really need a lot of close attention. Those patients should be assessed for falls risk, whether they're eligible to be taking calcium, vitamin D supplements, and perhaps some of the drugs like the Fosamax and Alendronate, some of the other drugs, to reduce the risk of fracturing if they fall. So maybe a corticosteroid policy is in order where we deal with these patients a little bit differently. What drugs increase the risk of bleeding? Many of our patients are now on heparin, whether it's intravenous or a lot of your low molecular weight heparins like your Lovenox. As you're getting these DVD patients and surgical patients discharged, they're at huge risk of hemorrhage. Warfarin, now all our mechanical valve patients and patients with DVTs and AFib, more and more patients are on warfarin all the time. That drug is at the top of the list of drugs putting people in the ER, hospital, or killing people because it is such a dangerous drug, but it's an essential drug. Antiplatelet drugs such as Plavix and aspirin contribute to bleeding risk. So many of our patients are on these drugs. We really should consider policies and procedures for how we assess and deal with falls risk in these folks. Again, if you're not doing it all the time, you're not doing it. And you don't have unlimited resources, I'm pretty sure of that. So by focusing on your patients with the highest risk, you're going to make the best use of the resources you do have. All right, so in summary, ambulation is an incredibly complex activity, and drugs affect virtually every one of those systems involved. Your patients are on many drugs. I think it's safe to assume that those systems are affected and that you systematically need to deal with your patients differently from a training point of your staff to the assessment of the patients by your staff, and to actually to the training of the patients themselves. So going forward, typical home patient had a recent index event. Most of them were hospitalized. They've got these multiple comorbidities, so we really need to do these things. Moving ahead, what can be done? These last few slides, I'll run through them, and we'd be willing to help you with these. I know Vicki talked about how the QIO projects for the next QIO contract don't address home care in the same way. We are moving ahead with drug safety issues. So the priorities for our team, for the pharmacy team, for the next scope are actually decreasing the use of avoidable drugs in the elderly and reducing clinically relevant drug-drug interactions. So we are still out there, and we're still willing to help home care agencies deal with these drugs better. And we have been in contact with some of the home care agencies in the state working on some of these things. So I'm available. We'll still be around. So if you want to continue to work on drug safety, please look us up. So what can be done? Staff training and things we talked about. Directing the resources towards your highest risk patients is important. And improving the responsiveness when you see things is vital. I want to run through real quickly some steps to medication simplification. These are based on an AHRQ document that was out there that I believe has already been posted to the home care webpage. And I invite you to visit that and to go over those things. But I'm going to take my own approach to these things and jump ahead to the slide that is entitled Remove Old and Expired Drugs. What we're talking about is the first step, and I know doing those home care admissions, how complex it is. You've got the OASIS, you know, questions you've got to ask and all those things. But I really think that preparing the work environment for patient drugs is the key to getting off on the right foot with any patient. If it can't be done in the first visit, perhaps subsequent visits, but have a plan of attack. There's a couple photos here just driving home the point. Here's a professional painter standing on three buckets. It's obvious he knows what he's doing but isn't taking the time to prepare his work environment properly. Our next-door neighbor is a contractor. He fell off a bucket, lacerated his head, working on our neighbor's house. He's 55 years old. He's been doing it for 40 years. What was he thinking? So we really need to prepare our work environment properly. The next slide gets the point of medications, why it's so important with medications. It's one thing to fall off a bucket, but here's a forklift with a bomb on it, and I'd like to think that this is, you know, the drugs are much more like this. We really need to handle the drugs much more carefully. Think about it. Products that in microgram quantities can make your body do stuff. We think about weapons of mass destruction and things. Drugs are chemicals that in microgram and milligram quantities can make your body do things. We really need to handle them much, much more carefully. The next slide is the way I'd like to see you consider it. It's like setting up for surgery. Lay things out. You're doing something of great importance. Be systematic. Have your nurses approach things in a way that's systematic and thorough, paying due attention to what they're dealing with. Taking inventory, all these things. I think we're actually running a little late. So, Vic, I'm going to leave it up to you. Should I run through these? We're going to keep going. So I won't speed up and blow through these, but I invite you back if you have to leave.
Yep.
What I recommend the nurses do, and again, I realize how much pressure is on the admission nurse and how complex some of these cases are, but really it's vital to take an inventory. Look at everything that's present. Don't just look for the drugs that are on the med list. Double check what is present against the med list. There may be necessary drugs that aren't on those orders. So you have 10 bottles, there's only 8 drugs on the med orders. What are those other two? Is it possible they stopped something when they went in the hospital or overlooked something? So it's not enough to just say, do I have the bottles of things that are on the med list? Those extra bottles need to be evaluated. Those drugs that aren't on the med list might be things the patient was taking that the hospital wasn't aware of that contributed to the problem that put them in the hospital to begin with. Samples, OTCs, things they got over the internet, things they got from a walk-in clinic. So it's not enough to just say, do I have the drugs in the house that are on the med orders? It's got to be a what is in the house, what is on the med orders, match them all up and say, what are these extras and what's the importance of them? It's possible you're going to find the patient's taking 2 or 3 different drugs that are similar or the same as you do that as well. Get the old expired ones out and remove them or discard them. And because of the cost with copays and cash payments and things now, I'd recommend sequestering the drugs, tying them up in a Ziploc baggie or something and putting them somewhere, but get them away from that work area. Treat it as a surgical suite. You're going to line things up and do things very systematically. You don't need those other things floating around. Next slide is preparing the work environment. Help the patient develop a system for maintaining order. Every patient's got their own thing. I've seen everything from the spinning spice rack to the upside down means I've taken them, right side up means I haven't, the caps are on, the caps are off, whatever works for the patient. But as you assess ability to take their own medications, they should be able to show you that they have a system in place that makes sense, especially on that move item on your OASIS. Can they show you that they have a system for doing things? Going on, here is a picture of me when I had more hair, less gray hair, with a patient a few years ago who had multiple medications. I've been in there. I know what the messes look like. I know how complicated it is. And this woman had multiple ER visits and rehospitalizations. It took several visits to go in and to walk through and straighten them out and come up with a system. But unless we do it, things are just going to keep happening. So we really do need to take the time to go through these. If it's not the first visit, have a plan for working through it. Maybe the inventory is the first visit. And as long as everything matches up okay, but the next visit we're going to work on the system, and the next visit we're going to work on adherence, but have a plan for how to work through these things. The next slide, single good pharmacy. Now, the AHRQ documents the single pharmacy. I inserted the good. And I think we all agree and we all are aware that there is a wide variation in the quality of services you get and your patients get from different pharmacies. And I'm always amazed to ask patients, which pharmacy do you go to, and they tell you, and then you ask them if they like them, if they know them, all those things, and many people say no, or they're frustrated. So why do we continue to go to these places? If you know where the good pharmacies are, it doesn't hurt to let the patients know this pharmacy delivers. This pharmacy will help you with that plan. This pharmacy will do these things to help you and to possibly steer the patients away from the prescription mills that are not really providing the level of care you need. So some simple questions to ask patients and have your nurses consider is, do you know your pharmacist by name? If they don't know them, there's not a relationship. A lot of the pharmacies, they may say, oh, John is there, or Sally's there, and she's wonderful, I only go when they're there. That's a sign they've got a relationship there that's valuable. Does a pharmacy deliver? You're using your staff, your home aides, and other people to go pick up drugs and things. There's probably a pharmacy in every area that's going to deliver. Are you satisfied with the time they spent with you? If not, why do we continue to go there? Are your pharmacists helpful to you when you have questions or problems? If not, why do you continue to go there? Would you consider using a different pharmacy if they offered better services? If the nurses know where the best pharmacies are in town, they're better staffed, they have more services, they'll spend more time, why aren't we asking our patients if they consider using them? Most of the pharmacies take all the insurance plans. They're going to charge the same amount if they've got Medicaid or a drug plan. Why not go to the one that's going to give you these value added? And how about possibly collecting this information from your patients? If time allows, if you have a nursing student or something, do a survey. Who are the better pharmacies? Who do they like? Who don't they like? How about sharing that data back with the pharmacies in the area? In our region right outside of Albany, I've got some friends who opened an independent pharmacy, and in the town where we live, there were some chain pharmacies that didn't deliver. And when they went into business, they made a point of going to the senior homes and providing all these services and things. Lo and behold, now the chain pharmacy that never did before delivers. Why? Because they realized that another pharmacy was getting their business because they provided better service. Collecting that data, especially if you're in a small town or something, could go a long way, you don't realize it, to changing how they practice. So collect and share that data with their pharmacies. Good pharmacies should be rewarded. The ones that are the prescription mills shouldn't be. How about non-drug alternatives? Thinking back to the earlier slides about what are we really trying to get out of our drugs, overactive bladder, if they're incontinent still and they're independent, maybe you don't need a drug. Diet and exercise with diabetes and hypertension, appropriate diet in your heart failure patients. Diuretics are only needed in your heart failure patients if they're necessary to control their fluid balance. If you can get the patients on the right diet and things, you can convince them possibly we can get your doses decreased. You might be able to get off this diabetes drug if you can lose 10 pounds and get your diet under control. I've had patients where I've gone in and found the menus, this elderly couple, the gentleman's got heart failure, the wife had COPD and everything, and they had 3 or 4 menus on their coffee table. They were ordering all their meals from the pizza joint, from the other takeout joint, from the Chinese. Those simple things of getting them on Meals on Wheels can change their diet. It could change the medications they're taking. So we really need to say, do I absolutely need a drug to be doing these things? Or are there simple things we can do, like Meals on Wheels and getting them to change their diets and things that could possibly decrease doses or get rid of drugs? And that actually increases the amount of care they get because they're being seen on a regular basis, someone's checking in on them, things like that. So drugs are not the magic bullet to everything. Going on to the next slide, coordinating doses with established daily routines. Amazed how many patients have drug regimens that impact their quality of life just from the numbers they take and the time of day they have to take them. Most vivid in my memory is an elderly gentleman whose wife was in a nursing home several miles away, and he stopped taking his morning Lasix because he couldn't go visit her the way he wanted. Let's ask the patients, are these drugs affecting how you live, and what can we do to make it easier for you to adhere? Otherwise, they're going to stop taking things without telling you, and it's going to put them at risk, and that doesn't help anybody. So ask directly about drugs interfering with their quality of life. Going on, long-acting and sustained-release products. I don't think we do a great job at doing this, especially as you're overwhelmed with 15 or 20 drugs. But the next couple slides relate to long-acting drugs and combination products. You can simplify drug regimens a lot as you change to drugs that are dosed less frequently and if you use combination products. And with HIV is the best example of combination products. When HIV drugs first came out, People were taking multiple drugs every 4 hours around the clock, and the drug companies got smart and started making regimens that were combinations, two or three drugs in them, sustained release, and now we're down to regimens or once or twice a day for HIV. The cardiovascular drugs are starting to catch up. You're seeing drugs like blood pressure drugs plus cholesterol drugs, combination diabetes drugs, combination antihypertensives. What we really need to do is start thinking systematically about evaluating patient drug regimens to say what is the simplest possible regimen that we can get these folks on. So long-acting products, there are drugs, not Fosamax, but now they're once-a-month and even once-a-year drugs for osteoporosis that they might consider. If you're doing three-time-a-week injections of erythropoietin, there's longer-acting darbepoietin, Aranesp, that's given once a week. How many visits, how many injections can you save? Toprol XL is once a day instead of two or three times a day. MS Continent, your pain management folks. Your folks should not be taking narcotics four, five, six times a day. There's sustained release products out there. If they're taking PRN doses every 4 hours, their pain's not properly managed. Patches can be given either once a day or perhaps even once a week, depending on the drug. Going on to using the combination products, here's some examples. Caduate's got Lipitor and Norvasc. Duoneb for the NEB treatments, Vasoretic. There are a lot more of these drugs coming out, so we need to think about not only simplifying their regimen, but also saving the money on their copays, especially if they're, you know, if they're paying 25% copay out of pocket. Getting a brand name drug with two in it is going to save them $25 a month, and you're going to make a friend for life when you save them that money. Crazy slide, Polypill. I used to kid around saying we need to make an oat bran muffin with all the cardiovascular meds in it, and they just take it once a day after seeing so many patients who couldn't eat breakfast after taking all their meds. But actually, there is an initiative underway looking at putting low doses of five or six other drugs, a statin, aspirin, ACE inhibitor, beta blocker, folic acid, in a single pill. And the idea is to market it in countries that don't have the established health systems that we have, but to reduce cardiovascular disease and deaths, heart attacks and strokes in these other countries, and they would make it available at a low dose. So don't be surprised in the next few years if you start seeing cardiovascular drugs with three or four things in each pill to make it, like the HIV drugs, something you can adhere to that you can take that's not going to wreck your budget. Going on, discontinue or substitute cautionary meds. I talked a couple minutes ago about our ongoing initiative for the next several years to reduce inappropriate drugs in seniors. So if you've got patients who are on drugs like propoxyphene or some of those anticholinergic drugs, they're generally ineffective. They've got side effect profiles that are not suitable for use in the elderly, and there's many, many alternatives available. And there are resources and tools available to help you identify those drugs and help get patients off of them. That would simplify the regimen, save them money, reduce the risk of adverse events. Okay. Steps are important. The next slide, but the best is not to walk alone. I saw this picture, and I just think of home care nurses going out there and practicing out by themselves in this vast wilderness, whether it's rural or urban, and you're thinking you're alone. And I think systematically we need to do a better job of tying home care into the other providers in the area. So let's just take a couple minutes and go over how I think we might be able to do that. Next slide is partnering with the people that refer patients to you and are also involved in their care. None of this is new to you. But there are initiatives ongoing that are making home care more important to the other providers. Things like pay for performance, accreditation by JACO. There are initiatives that are putting pressure on hospitals, physicians' offices, and now even the pharmacies to expect more of them. And you are caring for their high-risk patients. If a hospital is worried about the rehospitalization rate, 10 years ago they may not have wanted to talk to the home care agency because they thought you were just trying to get them to sign paperwork. Now you're saying, I have a drug list. I know what they're on. I know if they're adherent. I can help you manage your high-risk patients and reduce your rehospitalization rates. So I think more than ever, partnering with the hospitals and the other institutions makes a lot of sense. Going on to the next slide. Community pharmacies, and this is something we haven't done. Pharmacies, I would say I'll put the blame on pharmacy. Pharmacy hasn't done a good job at engaging home care, but I think home care hasn't done a good job about interacting with pharmacy either. We touched on how the quality of services vary a lot. There's a lot of competition. The expectations on them may be increasing. There are movements underway now to come up with quality measures to apply to pharmacies and to the drug plans that will relate to drug adherence, to adverse drug events, to the percentage of patients taking drugs that should be avoided. So there's now pressure on pharmacy to make them accountable for how their patients do. So if you are caring for their high-risk patients on 27 medications and they're being assessed by CMS or some accreditation body, they're now going to be more willing to speak with you too. So I really would recommend home care making a concerted effort to engage the pharmacy community. But how do we do that? And what can pharmacy do for us? The next slide just highlights how a lot of those points I talked about as far as simplifying drug regimens can be done by pharmacies. This is just a slide of a poster presentation I saw at a pharmacy meeting of a pharmacy service in an ambulatory care physician office. And they're affiliated with the College of Pharmacy. And if you look at the things they were able to do for their patients, things like getting them, saving them money by getting drugs that they could split the tablets and reduce their costs, switching to cheaper drugs within the class, getting combination products and stopping drugs, all those things you want to do for your patients, the pharmacies are capable of doing. Now, how do we get them to do it for us? Moving ahead, possible approach to community pharmacy would be to, first of all, think ahead. I know a lot of times your staff are calling pharmacies, I'm in the home, I'm out of such and such, and there's a problem, or what's the problem with the med order? To engage them, I think we need to be more proactive and to think of first a list of specific needs you have for your patients. Things like delivery, better counseling and education. There's a state law in New York that they must counsel their patients on new medications. Why aren't they doing it? How can they help you do it better? Checking for duplicative therapies. My nurses don't know what all these 37 meds are and what drug classes they're in. I need somebody that can do that. I don't know if there's combination products. I don't know if there's sustained-release products. Are there alternatives that aren't drugs? All these things, if you sit down and put your heads together, my guess is you can come up with a list of things that you would like pharmacy to do for you. And once you have the list, think about how you want to approach them. Going on to the next slide, not only what do you want from them, but what drugs do you really need help with? This is a slide of adverse drug events contributing to ER visits. And if you look, they assess tens of thousands of patients' cases, and it's obvious that warfarin, insulin, antiplatelet drugs, and some of these others are the major players. They're the drugs that are going to harm your patients and put them back in the ER. So in addition to saying, gee, what kind of services do I need from the pharmacy, what specific drugs am I worried about? How can pharmacy help you better manage your warfarin patients? How can they better counsel your insulin patients? Going forward, consider the needs of the pharmacy. It's not enough to set up a meeting with them to tell them this is what we need from you. You need to spend some time thinking about what might they need or what are the things that are putting pressure on them. You have things that they don't have. You've got clinical information. You know the labs. They may not get the labs. You know when a patient's gone in the hospital. You know when their status has changed and things. That's information they might need. They like getting reimbursed for things. There is in the Medicare Modernization Act, in the Part D, Medicare Part D legislation says that every Part D plan must offer a medication therapy management service. And many of the plans will reimburse pharmacies for doing these services for Part D beneficiaries who have multiple comorbidities and are using more than $4,000 in drugs a year. That's many of your home care patients. So you might be able to go to your pharmacies and say, we've got these high-risk patients. If you can help us do these things, we might be able to help you get reimbursed for it, and I'm sure you'll have their attention. OTC sales, they like selling things. So, and they sell gauze, they sell DME and those things. So possibly you could go to them and say, well, I know you need these things. How can you help us do this if we can help? It's worth the discussion. So thinking about what you need, thinking about what their needs are, and then orchestrating a visit. The slide heading possible approach to community pharmacy is once you get the list of an approach together, is set up a formal dialogue. Contact the pharmacy owners or the district managers. I say if you know who the better pharmacies are in the area, start with them first because they're already overachievers. Perhaps get your VNA administration to sit down with them. Insurers in the area, especially if they're a Part D provider that might reimburse for MTM services. Maybe get some representatives from the inpatient pharmacy department or discharge planning, pharmacy colleges, nursing schools in your area, and IPRO would be willing to help facilitate some of these discussions as well. So I'd recommend sitting down with them and saying, these are our high-risk patients, they're on many meds, these are the meds we're worried about, and come up with a plan to possibly meet those needs. One possible approach would be when we get a high-risk patient, we'd like you to please review it for duplications, for Beer's List meds, for these other things. If we fax it to you, could someone assess it within 24 hours and get back to us? And if possible, can we get you MTM reimbursement for that? So have a plan, a system for how can they help you do this. And one thing we're kicking around, and we've spoken to some different people in the state about, is setting up pilots with the pharmacy schools. They're training hundreds and hundreds of students on any given day, and many of them are placed in the retail pharmacy settings for their training. If they know where the pharmacy students are and when, and if you know which pharmacies your patients use, it's possible you could start a dialogue with the pharmacy school that says, let's do a pilot where your students who are on rotation do these things for our home care patients. And maybe you could get the ball rolling with the pharmacy where they do it on a regular basis, whether the students are there or not. So those are the types of engagements that I think we really need to make if we're going to break through. Those are the types of alliances that I think would be very helpful to your patients, be helpful to the pharmacy, and would make a system of change that's going to improve patient care. We have additional resources, as I said. We're working on what we call the DADE project here at iPro, where we've got a toolkit trying to educate and reduce the use of inappropriate drugs in seniors. I'm also going to be moving into drug-drug interactions, and I think warfarin's one of the big druggies in there. So please stay tuned for more information on those projects. So I think that covers most everything. We talked briefly about changing your system so you're assessing your patients systematically, orthostatic pressures, training your patients to get up all in the same way, things like that. But I really think it's a system approach. If you're not doing it all the time, you're not doing it. I think you need to engage the other providers to reduce the risk of patient harm. So with that, I'm going to leave it open to any questions. We've been going on for about an hour. I know maybe you're getting a little antsy, you need to get back to work, but I'd like to turn it back over to Vicki, and I'd be willing to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you so much, Darren. And as always, we really appreciate when you spend time with us. Harold, if we can open up the line for questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question or comment at this time, please press the 1 key on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key.
Again. Great. And thank you while we're waiting for some questions to queue up. Just some really high points that from what I took away from this presentation is, one, I've been promoting for as long as I've been in home care some very simplistic ways for clinicians to conquer or to really stay on top of the medications. And coming from an HIV specialty, this was some of what we did. And I just really liked the drugs that are being used for specific indications, for symptom control, treatment of real disease, and prevention. I think by stratifying them in such a way allows the clinician to be able to say, okay, much more than just making a list and making sure it matches, as Darren said. This is critical. We're critical thinkers as nurses, and we don't make lists. We assess, and and if we can't figure out what's going on, we ask for help. So I just love some of those simple things we can teach our new home care clinicians that you can really walk away from and teach them about today. So I do appreciate some of those simplistic interventions. And, Harold, do we have any questions in the queue?
We have no questions or comments in the queue at this time, ma'am.
Okay, great. Then we're going to end this conference call. And again, we thank you all for being with us. And you all enjoy your day.
I also invite anyone to follow up via email or call after if you're shy.
Please call us right away, and we'd be here to help you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. This concludes the program. You may now disconnect. Everyone have a wonderful day.